your source for everything paranormal.
Para-X.
The views expressed and the opinions given by the individual host and their guests do not necessarily reflect those of Para-X, its affiliates, or its sponsors.
Merry meet and merry part, bright the cheeks and warm the heart. For tread the circle thrice about, to keep unwelcome spirits out. Bide within the law you must, in perfect love and perfect trust. Mind the threefold laws you should, three times bad and three times good. These eight words the reed fulfill, and ye harm none, do what ye will.
Welcome to Stirring the Cauldron on the Para-X Radio Network. And now, here's your host, Marla Brooks.
Merry meet everybody once again, and welcome to Stirring the Cauldron. Tonight we're going to be talking about magical ink with my guest, author J.D. Walker. Now, J.D. is a master gardener and vice chancellor of the House of Akasha, North Carolina Pagan Group. She's a former business journalist and a garden columnist for almost 30 years and has contributed dozens of articles to Llewellyn's Almanacs. And when she was here last with us a couple months ago, we were talking about her wildcraft book. And either it was during the show or after the show, she mentioned something about magical ink. And my antennas shot straight up. And so I invited her back tonight to talk more about it. As always, chat room questions and comments are welcome. And if you're listening live and not here in the chat room, come join us at paraxradionetwork.com. JD, thank you for coming back so soon to talk about magical ink, because I've been looking forward to it ever since you mentioned it.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the invitation to come back. This is a fun topic for me. It's something I've been doing for probably about 15 or more years. Once you get into doing inks, you kind of get hooked on it.
Mm-hmm. So some people might not know exactly what magical ink is. Do a little explanation there. And when did you kind of learn about it and develop it and jump in with both feet?
Oh, well, I really got involved with it again probably back about 2002 or so, 2003. I've always known about some of the inks that people made from berries and things of that sort. For example, a friend of mine has some letters from the Civil War. He had an ancestor who fought in the Civil War. And according to my friend, what the soldiers would frequently do, because they frequently did not have the materials right at hand, the quills and the commercially made inks, is they would go into the fields around them and get berries of some sort, pokeberries if they were in season, blackberries, whatever berries they could find, mash those up in a cup, sharpen a pencil, a piece of wood, and that's what they would write with. Mm-hmm. Now, these letters, obviously, at the time he showed them to me, were probably 170 years old, and they were still quite legible. They were fading, most certainly. And in this case, the person had used pokeberry. A lot of people have heard where I grew up of using pokeberry ink. Not very many people made it, but they were at least aware that that was something the old folks used to do. You'll remember, you may have heard, and I still see it written, people will say that the Declaration of Independence or the Constitution was written with pokeberry ink. That isn't true. It was written with iron gall ink, which is another fascinating topic. But pokeberries were certainly around and certainly abundant at certain times of year in my area, and people made full use of them. So knowing that, that got me curious from the standpoint of kind of like folk art. And then when I got into my magical practices, it was just a very easy step to go from your basic homemade ink to enhancing it to make it a magical ink. And the way you do that is through timing or through the things that you put into the ink. And we can talk about that a little bit more as we go in through the show.
Mm-hmm. You know, because I'm reading up on it, and there are various types of magical ink, like dragon's blood, magic spell ink, money, green magical ink. I mean, there's probably hundreds of inks, no matter, you know, what you're looking for. But if it's someone that's never used it before, is there kind of a specific type for newbies, you know, like, mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, you can start out with just a very basic ink. For example, there are a lot of commercially made inks. Early on, I bought some. This was called a Dragon's Blood ink. I don't believe it has any of the Dragon's Blood resin. I don't know if your viewers can see that. There's a bit of a glare.
No.
But the a commercially made ink, this is a very old bottle, and you can see it's about gone. And it's just a very basic ink without any quote-unquote flavorings in it. You can start with a basic iron gall ink. Again, basic black ink. It's obviously made from the oak tree, so it gets some significance there. You could do soot lamp ink if you have lots and lots of patience. What you want to do is take a spoon or some metal instrument, light a kerosene lamp or a candle if you have nothing else, and literally hold it over the flame until it accumulates soot. Then you scrape mm-hmm. that off, and you do that some more. And you keep doing that till you go quite solidly blind, or you you finally get enough soot that you can mix that with some water, and if you need it, a fixative. And then it's just a basic black ink, very good to use. Now, it becomes a magical ink when you start adding enhancements to it. For instance, I have, let's start here. This is my backlog of Pugberry ink.
A gallon.
Yes. And you can see how much of it's already gone. I made this back in September, late September, early October. And I'm going through it quite a lot. That's quite a lick of it here that I've gone through. That's my base. And one of the reasons why I like using Poke as a base is that Poke has a lot of the same, the same correspondences as like Mandrake or mm-hmm. Dragon's Blood. Mm-hmm. It is a powerful ink or powerful magical tool. It lends energy to anything you put it with if you take the root and use that in your spell work, in your incenses or mojo bags, things of that sort. So the berries have the same association of lending that energy. Now, to be quite honest and upfront, pokeberry is a purgative. And for any of those folks who happen to know about a little bit about herbal medicine, a purgative is something that helps you to expel things. Mm-hmm. We used to, growing up in the springtime, when the poke was just beginning to come up, my mother would insist that we have two or three, it's called a mess in the South, just a big pot of mm-hmm. Poke greens, because it would help to clear your system out. The old mm-hmm. folks thought that over the winter, because you ate a lot of starchy food, you ate a lot of fatty food, your blood got too thick. Mm-hmm. So you had to do something to thin your blood out. And what they did was feed you poke greens. But the nice thing about it is they're also very good. But the important thing is that purgative effect lends the energy of banishing or cleansing. Mm-hmm. So if you need spell work done that requires that kind of energy, poke is also a very good herb, or ink in this case, to use for that purpose. That's your base. Once you have your base, whether you use iron gall or soot black or pokeberry or any other berries, we'll talk a little bit later about some of the things you can use. Mm-hmm. But once you do that, then you begin to add essential oils to it. And it's better in this case to use essential oils as opposed to plant materials, because it's already an organic solution. So you don't want chunks of other things blended in there. That's going to interfere with how well the ink actually moves from your quill or from your pen. So we use essential oils. And you mentioned, for instance, dragon's blood. So here's one of my little containers of dragon's blood. And all this is about 5 ounces of dragon's blood, pokeberry ink, to which I've added a thickening agent. And then I've added anywhere from 4 to 6 drops of dragon's blood essential oil. And that gives it not only the strength of the pokeberry, but it gives it the energy of the dragon's blood. When you talk about bat's blood, by the way, dragon's blood is a good general purpose ink if you make your own or if you buy it online somewhere. Mm-hmm. It's good for general purposes of any sort. If you are doing good work, prosperous work, or again, as we get into it, sometimes people need to do more baneful work, that's a good one to use. Bat's blood has a little bit of dragon's blood in it, and it also has cinnamon in it. Bat's blood is almost always used for dark purposes. Obviously, creature of the night, that's the association it has. Dove's blood, which is another popular one you find out there, is the base with cinnamon and myrrh for the loving energy, the healing energy, things of that sort. Mm-hmm. So that should lead your listeners to understand that you can adjust your inks to very specific purposes. For instance, if I wanted to make an ink that I would only use mainly in healing, I might want to use rosemary essential oil, juniper essential oil, any of the healing essential oils that I would use for general health care could be used in that ink. And then that ink set aside to use strictly for that kind of spell work or that kind of ritual work. You can begin to draw some associations by combining things. For instance, if I wanted to, and I've done this sometimes, if I wanted to make this a darker, blacker ink, I might actually use some of the oak galls. I wish I'd had the presence of mind to go get my supply of oak galls, and I just didn't manage to think to bring that. For those listeners who don't know what an oak gall is, it's a little marble-looking thing. It's a little brown thing that forms on an oak tree, usually around May or so, when a particular wasp comes and stings the tender portion of the oak branch, the early tender growth of the oaks that are growing out in your yards. And it's all kinds of oaks. It doesn't have to be a specific kind. Mm-hmm. When they sting it, or whenever they bite into it, they lay an egg. And the response of the tree is to form a gall around it. Mm-hmm. And the galls can range anywhere from about the size of a sweet pea to the size, of a small marble. They don't usually get very much bigger than that. Mm-hmm. They are tan. They are hard as a rock. And then in the, usually around August, September, in that period of time, the wasp will hatch out and you'll see a little tiny hole where the bug has come out of the gall. The gall will drop off. So what I do as I walk through the woods that time of year, anytime I see these little balls laying down on the ground, I gather them up. When you crush them, there's a lot of tannins in there. Mm-hmm. The minute you add a fixative to it, like alum, after you have cooked these in enough water, usually just enough to cover the galls themselves after you've crushed them up, the minute you add some alum to it, it immediately goes black. It's a very interesting process to watch. Mm-hmm. So if I wanted to make this an even stronger magical ink for dark purposes, I might add some oak gall ink to that to improve the energies there.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, 30 years as a garden columnist, you know your plants and stuff. There's a question in the chat room from Kat. She says, "Poke is toxic unless treated properly, is it not?"
This is an interesting question that comes up, and I'm frequently asked this, and I write about it in my book. That's one of the common plants that we talk about in The Witch's Guide to Wildcraft. Poke has, I believe they're called oxalates in it, and some saponins in it. When you are eating poke, eating the plant, You usually get the young leaves, usually no more than about 6 inches long. And you get, as I say, a large mass of them. We call it a mess, enough to go into a pot. Put water in it. You cook it until the leaves wilt down. When the leaves are wilted down, you pour that water off, put the leaves back in the pot. You boil them again. Mm-hmm. You pour that water off, usually about 30 minutes later. Put them back in the pot. You boil that mess of greens up again. And you would think by this time the leaves would just be falling apart, turning to mush, mm-hmm. but they're not. Mm. What you have done is you've washed a lot of those chemicals out. Now, those chemicals are what give the poke its purgative effect on your body. Mm-hmm. And certainly if you ate too much of it, or if you did not boil them to render those chemicals out as much as you could, then that would probably give you some cramping. You wouldn't feel particularly good. You definitely would be cleaned out. But it will not kill you. I mean, you literally would have to sit there and chew on the raw leaves. I can't imagine how many you would have to eat in order to do some serious harm. And certainly if you were force feeding some kid that many, then it certainly wouldn't be good for the kid. But frankly, you couldn't do that. If you tried to eat any quantity of poke leaf at all, you would probably throw up. It's not a good tasting plant when you first pull it off of the stalk. So it has to be boiled. It has to be boiled repeatedly. And then usually what we did with it at home was after that third boiling, and again, three was a requirement. You had to boil it off three times. Then we would stir fry it, usually with bacon fat or pork fat of some sort, and then mix in scrambled eggs with it. Mm-hmm. And that's where you get poke salad. I'm sure some of your folks have heard that term used from time to time.
We know the song, poke salad.
Yes, we do. Mm-hmm. So that's a long answer to the question of, will this hurt me if I ingest it? Certainly you would not eat the berries, because that's going to be concentrated. You can't boil the chemical out of the berries. Mm-hmm. There's no reason to be eating in the berries in the first place. They don't do anything for you. I can't imagine why in the world you'd want to eat it unless you just wanted to turn your mouth purple. Get your fingers purple too, because the berries give a very persistent stain. So in that case, I would say as long as you prepare it correctly, there's very little trouble with eating it. And even if you messed up and didn't do it quite as much as you needed to, it's not going to kill you. It won't make you feel very pleasant, but it's not going to kill you. I will go ahead and add that back in the 70s, there used to be a series of books called Foxfire. I don't know if the company is still putting them out or not, but they included a whole lot of folk recipes from the Appalachian Mountains and the backwoods of Georgia, Tennessee, and places like that. And my mother actually tried this one time, and they were recommended taking some of the young stalks, washing them, cutting them like you cut okra, breading them, and frying them. Mm. Mama tried it. We tasted it. Wasn't good. So that was the last time we ever got around to eating that. But again, didn't kill us, didn't hurt us. It just wasn't a very pleasant meal. Certainly not as good as a good bowl full of poke salad.
Yeah, well, she said that some sources say simply collecting it at the wrong stage can be toxic. So, you know.
That's an interesting point. We were always told growing up that you get the spring herb. And again, notice that I said you pick the young leaves, about six mm-hmm. inches long. The old folks said, when I was growing up, once the plant sets flower, you don't eat it anymore. You don't pick it anymore. Mm-hmm. Because by that time, of course, it's getting more and more of those chemicals that are going to have that bowel movement effect on you. So the leaves would be tougher. They would be more filled with those chemicals and probably would be harsher on your system. As far as handling the plant, would you absorb it in your skin, through your skin that way? No. Now, you will find, and I believe Susan Weed actually mentions this, that And I hesitate to even mention this because I don't want to give people the wrong impression. The root does have some benefits in herbal medicine that is supported by some scientific research for help with certain cancers. But there is certainly a large concentration of the chemicals in the root, and some people will have a problem with contact dermatitis from just digging and handling the root. So if you want to harvest the root for your magical work, I would strongly suggest that you wear gloves whenever you dig the roots up, and as you are processing the root, wash it really good to get all the dirt and such off. Go ahead and chop it up, because if you wait for it to dry to chop it up, you'll never be able to chop it up. It gets hard as a brick bat. But go ahead and chop it up. And while you are handling it, while it's in that fresh state, I would certainly wear gloves if you had any concerns whatsoever about contact dermatitis. I've never really had any problem with it, but my experience wouldn't be someone else's experience. Some people may be more sensitive to it.
Yeah. You know, I'm sitting here and I'm thinking, let's see, how far does it go back that people even started using ink? You know, I mean, that you could like use rocks and you can put things in the dirt and everything, but where did they think to put a pen or, you know, a quill or something to ink to actually write? I mean, I don't know.
Well, essentially, you have to get back to the point of time when we get some sort of paper or vellum or something to write on. Certainly, you can put any of these inks on a wall, like a cave wall or a plastered wall of some sort, and get some kind of staining to take place. But you almost have to wait until you get something to write on before you find a really good use for inks. So I would say easily you go back into Babylonian times, Egyptian times, and people realize that if I wanted to make a permanent mark, for instance, on papyrus, I can do that by using inks, or of course they were also developing more what would more properly be called paints, that would be a little bit more resilient, made with oils and minerals, colored minerals. Certainly, we're familiar with the concept of using the crushed, colorful beetle shells in order to use paints and things. But certainly, by the time they were able to develop paper or things to write on, they were developing inks of a variety of whatever they happened to have around. Indigo is a common plant in the Mediterranean, I believe, that if you use the leaves, you can get a pretty kind of bluish purplish ink out of it. So while they would not have been working with pokeberries, I'm sure they had plenty of other different fruits and roots and things of that sort to make different colored inks out of way, way, way back in time.
And I wonder who the wise guy was that decided to pluck a feather out of a bird to make sure that, you know, and sharpen a quill. I mean, of all things, who sat there and said, huh, now we need something to write with. Feather.
What you need is something that has a hollow tube. And of course, you can do this with reeds.
Sure.
But we've got lots of feathers, and the birds are always throwing them off anyway. So if you can find a large enough feather, this is just happens to be someone colored a goose feather. But you see, it's got a ready-made reservoir to hold the ink.
Yeah.
It's already a hollow tube. And sometimes you will – I don't have anything small to stick in here. Sometimes you have to use something, a piece of wire, to – go into the quill like this, because there might be a little pith in there. So you can work that out with a wire or some sort of straight metal tongue type thing to get in there and make your reservoir hollow. And then when you dip it in, this happens to be a pretty good one. I can show you. I played around a little bit. My friend loaned me one of her inexpensive ink pens, and it has what's called a nib on the top. She has several different ones. These have broader chips there. I'm not sure if you can see those. But I played around with it a little bit. If you can again, I don't know if that's going to be too much glare or not. You can see some of the varieties of printing I've got. This was done with my quill. And again, I'm much more comfortable working with the quill than I am the nibs. You see, I can get a nice fine line on there to write whatever I want to write. Mm-hmm. The thicker lines were made with the nib. And I also wanted to show you something else here. I happen to have just a tiny little bottle of ink that I made. Oh, my goodness. This ink is probably 7 or 8 years old, or this is what's left of some that I made 7 or 8 years ago. And this first line, if you can see, was written with that 7 or 8 year old ink. You see it's still holding up reasonably well. It's going to be more brown than, for instance, this straight up poke ink that's from this year, but it's still quite usable. And as long as the material is kept away from direct sunlight, it will last a good long time. Mm-hmm. This particular line was ink that I made this year. You see, it's a little darker, got a little tinge of red to it or purplish color to it, more so than the top line. And then just as by way of comparison, that bottle of commercial ink that I showed you, it's every bit of 10 or 15 years old, holding up very well. It will hold its color longer. That's the nice thing about the organic inks is that they will fade. Usually that's not a problem if you're doing spells, writing spells out, because mm-hmm. you're probably going to burn it or bury it or toss it in water anyway, so you don't have to worry mm-hmm. about it. But if you will handle them with care, I can show you this. This, again, is from one of my books, and I apologize for the lighting, but you can see that this was written about 10 years ago. Still quite legible. Mm-hmm. And what I will want to do probably this year sometime is go back over that and touch it up, because this is my spell book or book of shadows, whatever you want to call it. Yeah. And I want to keep these particular spells. So mm-hmm. I might want to go back over that with trace it over again with this year's ink in order to maintain it. But I'm not worried about it going very far anytime soon. It will still be around for a good long time.
That's funny, because when I was looking around, I was reading about making invisible magical ink. And yes. They said that you use lemon juice, mm-hmm. and with a quill pen or a paintbrush, you write a message on a parchment paper and you let it dry. And as the liquid dried, the message disappeared. And to reveal the hidden message, you simply held the parchment over a heat source, like a candle or a light bulb, right?
Exactly. And if you have something like that you need to have hidden so that no one would know to look for it unless you told them to look for it, mm-hmm. that's a very good way to do it. I remember doing that in elementary school, where we wrote with magical ink using the lemon juice. That was a lot of fun, but not a lot of staying power to that sort of thing.
No, I mean, I was just kind of, you know, here you're talking about fading and whatever, and all of a sudden I read that thing about the invisible ink, and that's
interesting, because if you were using lemon, and some people don't make this association, lemon would be used to write love messages. So you could write, because lemon has the love correspondence. It's not, people look at it and say, oh, it's yellow, it must be associated with the sun. It's not. So you can write your little love notes and send them to your loved one, and he or she knows to hold it up to a light to see what sort of love message you've sent them.
Oh, that's very cool. I don't know why I'm giggling over it. It's just kind of something I never really thought about. And yeah, and I can see, I guess my childhood was not as educational as it should have been, because, you know, I think lots of kids know how to do that. And to me, it was just like, oh, wow, I'm sitting there reading this. I got to try it. Got to get some parchment. So,
oh, it's lots of fun to do. Now, when you're making the inks, just to go over the process of it.
I think I'm going to take a break first. Sorry. No, that's okay. Yeah, it'll be a good thing to come back and talk about that. All right, so everybody stay put, grab a lemon and think about invisible ink, and we'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
Stirring the Cauldron will be right back, so don't go away.
If you end up with webbed feet,
remember, you've been warned.
Explore the second edition of the Witch's Oracle Deck through 45 innovative cards and enhanced guidebook that peers into the world of the witch. The deck's stunning artwork has a new look and includes 7 brand new inspirational cards. Each card now includes a suggested crystal or gemstone to enhance your reading, as well as a magical incantation that provides energy, reinforces the card's meaning, and helps the desired message to be sent out into the universe. The easy-to-navigate guide also has a new look and offers straightforward, gentle guidance that takes readers through both good times and bad. And now includes a chapter on crystal and gemstone divination by the amazing Nicholas Pearson. The Witch's Oracle. It is a perfect divination deck for witches as well as non-pagans, and is designed to suit both seasoned readers and beginners alike. Find out more about the Witch's Oracle deck at www.marlabrooks.com, and you can purchase the deck from schifferbooks.com, amazon.com, or order a copy from your favorite bookseller.
New Aeon Now. News and discussion of the metaphysical, the occult, the paranormal, and much, much more. With your hosts, New Aeon High Priestess Reverend Lily Alley, head of the Draken chapter of the Order of Paranormal Exploration, Christine Matza. The New Aeon is now. Join us every Thursday night at 10 p.m. Eastern for New Aeon Now.
Welcome back to Stirring the Cauldron. Once again, here's your host, Marla Brooks.
And my guest tonight is J.D. Walker, and we're talking about magical ink. And I just want to say, you know, we didn't mention this, but some people might be taken aback by this, but magical ink, when you're talking about dragon's blood, when you're talking about dove's blood, when you're talking about any kind of animal's blood, no animals have been harmed to make this blood. I mean, they just call it. I wonder why they call it. Well, dragon's blood, we know. And I saw something about butterfly's blood. Now, that was really interesting.
Yeah, I think this question comes up periodically. Do you believe that when the original people were making these various and sundry spells and said, use, for instance, dove's blood ink or dove's blood to write your message or make your sigil or whatever you were doing, were they really using dove's blood, or were they really using bat's blood or cat's blood or whatever the animal they were calling for? And quite honestly, given the human's evolution, it wouldn't surprise me in the least if several thousand years ago they were using literal animal blood. The idea being that blood is life essence. Blood is energy in and of itself, whether it's human blood. And we have spells where they talk about pricking your finger and writing, signing your name with human blood. That was a very powerful element for people. But over time, when they had less access to these sorts of things, you started to find substitutions. And it's not uncommon for, as humans evolved, that they used this notion of transference. If you recall, there have been many ancient kingdoms where when the ruler died, several people were killed to be put in the tomb with him or her to help him or her in the afterlife. But over time, they begin to use little clay figures because the sensibilities changed. Maybe they were looking at it from an economic standpoint, saying, why would I lose this valuable slave or valuable vizier or whoever it might be when that person could stay with us? So we will create these little figures to use as a substitute, empower those, and they will do the same thing. And I'm sure that that's part of the sensibility that came about with people saying, I can't get doves to make my dove's blood ink. So what can I use in substitution? So I will get something that looks the same. Mm-hmm. I will enhance it with certain oils or herbs. And that is what I will call dove's blood ink. But yes, to reassure your listeners, I wouldn't dream of using real animal substances in order to do any of this. The only thing I use for my animals is the occasional cat claw that drops off, or I do snip a little black dog fur off every now and then.
And then there's the whiskers. They fall out.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, yeah. Anything you're doing that requires that kind of cat-like energy. The cats are very good to donate some of these over time. You just have to watch and pick them up whenever they fall off.
That's it. And it's a good thing that we don't need to use anything else that cats drop off all the time.
I don't even want to think about it.
Yeah, no, we're not going to go there.
I'm glad you brought that up, though, because that does come up, and people think, oh, no, you're actually using animal essences.
Because somebody in chat room earlier asked about using organic things like octopus blood, octopus ink, sorry.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly something that would discharge from the animal, because I have heard in Stragan, I think it is magic, Aurelian magic, that because they had access to it, that was something that could be used. And it's something that the animal can give off without necessarily being killed. Now, that's not to say that some people didn't go out and snatch up some octopus and grab the ink sac. But they're coming to the notion now, I'm trying to remember what country it was, that just declared that octopus and any creatures that were in that family were of such sentience that they actually were stopping the harvesting of them and the general sale of them. I can't remember now what country it was. So just an interesting little side note there.
Yeah. Now, you were going to talk to us about how to make and prepare it, but there's one question that I was going to ask, and if it didn't slip out of my mind really that fast. Oh, here it is. magical ink can be found in most occult stores as well as places like Amazon.com.
Exactly.
Making it ourselves, my guess is that when we make our own magical ink, it's probably more powerful than those that we can get commercially. Am I correct?
Exactly. Okay. And there again, as we mentioned the first time I spoke with you, one of the reasons for my writing the book that I wrote is to help people understand that they don't have to source materials from exotic places. They don't have to rely on going to a store to get some kind of herb, for instance, to help with prosperity. Mm-hmm. They have that material in their yard. And when you collect it respectfully, process it correctly, store it correctly, charge it correctly, whether you're talking about herbs or inks or whatever you're talking about, making your own tools even for that matter, you are putting your energy in it. You're concentrating on putting your needs into that particular material and storing it there like a little battery, so that when you need it to write that prosperity spell or to write that healing spell or whatever it is you happen to be doing, of course you're going to charge the work while you are doing it, but you've got a head start, because you've already charged that ink. You made it yourself. You know what energies you put into it. I don't want to get on too much of a bandstand about whether or not this stuff was made with petrochemicals or what they use to come up with it. But I suspect it probably was. Whereas I know mine is organic. It comes from the earth. It will go back to the earth. It won't harm anything in the meantime. So I feel much more comfortable making my inks or gathering a lot of my own herbs so that I know where they came from, how they were handled. I know they are handled respectfully, stored respectfully, and charged correctly because I did it.
Mm-hmm. Is there like a list of things, like different properties of things? You know, you can look up incense and essential oils and get the properties of them. If somebody wants to make their own magical ink, and aren't familiar with certain properties, is there like some kind of a list or something that would be the same like you would get with incense?
Well, you can certainly use, well, for instance, in this book, in the Witch's Guide to Wildcraft.
Okay. I found this on the web for like a...
Siri just jumped in. All right.
That's all right. Hey, Siri had his 2 cents too.
Scare the hell out of me.
the inks, or excuse me, the plants, the plant material that will lend an energy to your ink, the correspondences to the plant will lend that energy to the plant. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, if we are using the poke as an example, we know that if we look at the correspondences for poke, that it is an uncrossing type of plant. It's an energy lending plant, so it will give those energies to your inks. If you are talking about walnuts, for instance, we know that that's a particular witchy type plant, mm-hmm. that it has associations that will give strength to your inks if you're making inks out of it, and give staying power to your magic. So the qualities of that plant, if it is something that will give you color, because obviously some plants won't give you enough color to do anything, it will lend that energy to your ink. So the answer to the question is, look up the material in my book or Scott Cunningham's book, or if you have a reliable source on the internet that you trust to give the correct correspondences for the plant. When you read the correspondences for the plant, you will know that they will transfer to the ink. And some of them you may not find have particular correspondences. For instance, lamp soot. It doesn't really have any kind of correspondence to my knowledge. But tea. Tea is a good luck herb. It's a prosperity herb. So if you want to make a nice brown ink out of tea, then you know that you will have those powers of prosperity and good luck that will lend themselves to your brown ink.
Mm-hmm. Does color make a difference in magical ink?
It really does. And again, that's because everything we do in magic has can be affected by color. We usually think of blues, for instance, for healing and truth and honesty. We think of purples for more spiritual purposes. I kind of like the pokeberry ink because it kind of crosses the line between kind of a purplish and a reddish color. So I get that energy to it from the reds, and I get that more spiritual impact from the purplish colors. Anything that you're doing, if you want to do, for instance, a green ink, using things like spinach or kale or carrot tops, those, if you boil them, will give you a reasonably rich green ink. It won't necessarily be as green as that, but it will be noticeably green. Mm-hmm. So you can use those to lend power. I would use, for instance, green colored inks, possibly for fertility or for prosperity. Anything mm-hmm. that you would normally do with the color green, you could do with that. Black is a good all-purpose color. It takes in everything. We usually say black for dark purposes, but that doesn't have to be the case. Obviously, walnut would be a good example of that. But again, if you can match the color of the ink to the spell work you're doing, that's great. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you can't. I mean, you end up with a whole shelf full of all different kinds of colors of inks when maybe you can make do with one or two basic colors, the reds or the blacks or the blues, in order to cover most of your purposes.
Okay. So you were, before the break, you were going to talk about how to start creating your ink.
Yes, and it's a very, well, except for the lamp soot and the oak iron gall ink, those are labor intensive and a little bit more difficult to do. But for most plant materials, what I do, for instance, with my pokeberries is I get my cauldron full, and I do this in an iron cauldron. I kind of mash them down a little bit. and I put enough water in them to just barely cover the berries. Now, I have heard some people say, oh, don't put water on your berries, whether you're using cherries or blackberries or pokeberries in this case, because that waters down the ink. Well, that's not a concern for me because in my process, I'm going to boil it down anyway. But I put it in an iron cauldron because you really need to have a fixative for your inks to help hold that color, and iron will hold that color. If you don't happen to have an iron kettle or something like that to cook your inks off in, then you can also go to the vitamin store and get bottles of iron like you would take, like a lady would take for during her reproductive years to make sure that she had enough iron in her blood if she was interested in pregnancies and that sort of thing. But since I have access to iron, I like to cook my stuff in iron. That lends a little bit of a fixative to it. And then the second thing that you can do is once you have strained the ink out or the juice out, I put it back in the pot. I usually cut the volume by half. Now, I have not done that with my my backlog of ink because I seem to be going through quite a lot of it this year. So to get that thickening, rather than boiling it down, I'm actually going to add about a half teaspoon, a quarter to a half teaspoon of alum to about half a cup volume of liquid. And it's just a little, you can see, it looks like cornstarch. Yeah. And I've actually heard of people using cornstarch. I haven't tried that myself. But the alum is going to thicken it so that I don't have to boil this down by half and lose half of my volume. I can just use some of the alum in there. And you have to experiment with it a little bit just to see. A lot of recipes do call for a half teaspoon to a half cup of liquid. And I find that that makes it a little bit too thick. I don't like the viscosity of that. So you'll need to do a little bit of experimenting. My general rule of thumb is after I have either reduced the volume down or if I'm using alum, I stir it in there while the ink is still, or the berry juice, the liquid, is still warm. I stir it until I can take the spoon up and the ink sheets across the back of the spoon. Mm-hmm. So anyone who's made jelly knows what that is.
Yeah, I was just going to say, yeah, if there's exactly. Custard, you know custard, it's thick enough exactly. When it covers. Yeah,
pancake batter is another one. Just enough to sheet. You don't want it to hold thick on the spoon, but just enough to sheet. When you get it to that consistency, then you've got an ink that will generally flow pretty easily off a quill or off of a nib and do just fine for you like that. And again, that also, I've got my components mixed up here. The alum is used for the fixative. The gum arabic is what we're going to use to thicken it. I apologize if I'm getting my steps out of order here. As far as thickening agents, if you didn't have gum arabic to thicken it up, I have seen recipes that call for honey. And again, that's just something that will sweeten it. Honey has a preservative nature to it too. So there should be less chance of it spoiling. I've heard of some people using Elmer's glue. And again, that's just enough thickening. I have no idea how much you would use, but you can experiment with this. And thicken your base liquid up just enough so that it will flow nicely off of the quill or off of the nib. You'll just have to experiment with that to see how well it works. And the final thing you need to do is add a preservative. Now, the iron helps to preserve it. If you were using honey as a thickening agent, that would help to preserve it. But you can also use vitamin C. Just take one of your tablets of vitamin C, crush it up into a powder, mix that into the ink while it's warm, and that will help to cut down on any mold growth, any bacterial growth, because it's organic. It's going to have a tendency to want to grow mold or mildew if you don't do something to inhibit the growth of the mold or the mildew. You can use vitamin E. Use either buy the bottles of vitamin E oil. And again, it's about a half teaspoon to a half cup of volume. You can use vinegar. Vinegar is a very good one and will also help to work as a fixative to help it to hold its color a little bit more. And finally, any of your essential oils that are antibacterial, antifungal, antiviral, you can use those at the rate of about a half teaspoon to a half a cup of volume. And those, that gets back to the blending part of it. So that if you needed the energy that you might get from thyme, you're adding that in there as a preservative, but it's also lending that energy to your ink. So any of those oil, essential oils, that would be thyme, oregano. You can use the oil of the olive leaf. I would not use olive oil, but olive leaf essential oil would be a good antibacterial. Tea tree oil. All of those are good things that inhibit the growth of bacteria, mold, things of that sort. And finally, although this has been sitting in little cabinet that I have back in my ritual area, it's never been refrigerated, and it's held up just fine with just the preservatives that I put into it whenever I first made it. Until I actually blend my base ink, I'm going to be leaving that in the refrigerator. That's just an extra added step to make sure that I don't have to worry about going to pour it out 2 months from now and realizing that it happens to have grown mold. Mm-hmm. So that's another step that you can take to keep your inks from spoiling. And that will be something that you'll, as you get experienced with making your own inks, you'll realize what sort of controls work best for you in your particular environment.
Yeah, I mean, it's so fascinating. When are you going to write the book of recipes?
I haven't thought about that. I'm still trying to finish the book on the trees.
Well, okay. I'll give you a break. But yeah, because, I mean, it's probably not complicated, and probably, you know, there is a lot on the internet that you could find and you know, steps taking and, you know, what to do and what to use. But you know, if it's a reliable source, you don't know. Now, we know that you're a reliable source. So, in other words, that has to be your book after this one.
I think I'll get to work on that next.
Yeah, I think you should.
The encouragement.
So, and again, you know, it's probably like trial and error as you get going. I mean, I'm sure your first batch might not have, you know, been exactly what you wanted it to be. But, you know, in time you learn. And if we're making our own spells, you know, creating our own spells and our own inks, you know, it's not something that you have to read from a book. Sometimes, you know, it will come to you. You know, if you have a knowledge of plants, if you have a knowledge of witchcraft, you know, writing with quills. I mean, when I was a kid, the big thing was, and that was back in the Dark Ages, but we had ballpoint pens and all that. But in school, you know how everybody starts a trend, and they had those pens that that had the nibs, and you had that little thing on the side, and you could suck up the ink on that, and you could use that. And those were fascinating. And I'm just sitting here as you're talking about it and thinking, oh, my God, that would be so nice to have one of those nice, fancy old pens, old-fashioned pens.
Every now and then I find, because I'm bad to go through thrift stores, every now and then I will see these little sets where they have the little silver holder and a couple of little bottles, and there's this place where there used to be a quill or there used to be one of the old fountain pens you're talking about. Wouldn't that be nice to have?
Yeah, and I always had a problem because I'm left-handed, and so time I started to use the pen, you know, with the liquid ink in there, I would smudge it. I would write it out, and my hand would just smudge it. And I was so frustrated, you know, because I loved doing it, but I couldn't, you know, get around to the point that I could get my hand up enough not to ruin what I wrote, but it was still fun.
Well, and that is, I'm glad you mentioned that, because that is a bit of a concern when you, this happens to be, this paper that I wrote on and was showing earlier happens to be a cardstock paper, because I didn't happen to have any of my parchment paper. But when you first write on it, it will, the ink will tend to stand there until it hardens, and it will soak some to some degree down the paper. You'll see that it did not soak through the paper. That's an indication if it soaks through that maybe you need a little bit more thickening agent. But if you do write with this, you need to give it a few minutes to dry. And I don't know if you recall, those ink stands that they used to have also used to have a pad, and it was a half moon shape.
Yep.
Usually some sort of wicking material. And after it had set for just a little bit, they would carefully roll over the written signature or whatever you happen to have written, if you needed to get it out immediately, to soak up the excess. So if you are using your inks, if you're using your inks, do make plans in your spell work or whatever you're doing to allow it to set and dry a little bit before you try to fold it up or put it away in your book of shadows or whatever you might be wanting to do with it, because otherwise it will smear.
Yeah. You know, this hour goes by really, really, really too fast.
It did. I don't realize it. It's almost 60 minutes. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, almost. So, you know, I think this is a good time to tell people about where they can get your Wildcraft book, and because things that they need to make ink is in that book.
Exactly. Thank you very much. Because for those of those who are interested, I do explain in a little bit more detail how to go about making the pokeberry ink, and I mentioned some of the other ones there. I believe, of course, this will be a couple years in the future, so your readers or your listeners will have forgotten it. That is on the agenda for a future almanac article that I will be doing for Llewellyn to talk to folks about how to make a various and sundry amounts of inks. Oh, and by the way, I want to add real quick, if you are doing these with a star coming up in about 3 or 4 months, once you find your materials that would make a good ink, those will also be good dyes for any of your egg projects that you happen to be doing for Ostara. In the meantime, please do look for my book, A Witch's Guide to Wildcraft. You can find it obviously at Llewellyn, but you can also find it online at Amazon. And it's in, I'm very pleased to say, it's in most major bookstores. Quite a lot of the pagan bookstores too. Thank you very much.
Yes, yes. Good. I love it. Well, you know, come back at some point. You know, there's always good stuff coming out of your mouth and out of your brain. And so, yeah, we'll maybe talk about more Wildcraft. And when you get trees done, we'll do that too.
That's
really
sounds
interesting.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for sharing your knowledge, and I want to thank everybody who is listening, whether you're live or, you know, podcast, and the podcast for anybody will be up tomorrow, so go look for it. We'll find it on Podomatic and all kinds of 100,000 other places, my website, and anyway, until next time, everybody, blessed be, and merry meet again. Good night.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Stirring the Cauldron with Marla Brooks. Please join us again next week at the same time for another great guest and more cauldron stirring. Any rebroadcast or other use of this program without explicit permission is strictly prohibited. Copyright 2024. The Mysterioso March by Kevin MacLeod is licensed through Incompetech.com.